Hello and welcome to Endeavors on this Monday, August 17th. I'm Dan. I'll be with you for the next hour. We've got a great, great show today. You'll hear from environmental activist Emily Hunter. Her father founded Greenpeace and is the subject of a new documentary by Jerry Rothwell called How to Change the World. And you'll also hear from some of our Pride coverage. I had a chance to speak with two self-identifying agender demisexuals, so you'll learn about what that is. But first, here is Emily Hunter.
Emily Hunter, thanks so much for being here. Welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Let's talk a little bit about this movie, how to change a life, or sorry, how to change the world. How did you get involved with this? Did Jerry Rothwell come to you with a plan of what he wanted to do?
Yeah, I mean, first off, it's a pretty lofty title, How to Change the World, but I think it does it justly. Jerry had approached our family about 7 years ago, a couple of years after my dad had passed away. And this was a story he really wanted to tell. My father wanted to have told probably before I was even born. This was an idea of my dad. And it was really the story of a small group of people in Vancouver who helped to create a group that eventually helped to change the world. And that group is Greenpeace, one of the biggest environmental groups today. But it started on a Women of Prayer and not much resources and not much of a crew, but just a group of friends who had these lofty ideas of changing the world.
On that note, I mean, obviously there was activism before Greenpeace came along, but it seems like Greenpeace changed not only our knowledge and education, but the way activism was done. What can you tell us about how Greenpeace has affected the way we talk about issues?
For sure, yeah. I mean, absolutely. The environmental movement is much older. It's 200 years old, if not probably much older, if you consider the work of First Nations communities that were long here before us. And so, what I think Greenpeace and this group of people in the 1970s kind of brought forward was, if anything, a kind of a mesh of varying other movement and teaching they kind of brought forward into the environmental movement, kind of brought it into the modern-day environmental movement. And what I mean by that is they brought some such things as kind of Gandhi's teaching around more civil disobedience actions. They also brought kind of Quaker ideas of bearing witness, but also the movements of the civil rights movement, some of the teachings of Martin Luther King, and also First Nations commitments in terms of sit-ins and other direct action tactics. And so what they kind of brought this mesh is, as I say, primarily kind of direct actions and putting your bodies in harm's way for the planet, not just kind of protesting or lobbying as it might have been done before, but actually putting yourself in harm's way. And then also this point with the media of bearing witness, and then not just bearing witness, but sharing that with the world on a much larger scale using the early broadcast media at that time.
And now we're in the day and age where social media, Twitter and Facebook, give us another element to activism. How has that either helped or hurt the way in which we are activists about issues that are close to us and how that relates to Greenpeace?
Yeah, I think what we are experiencing now is this kind of new evolution of media tools with the digital mobile tools that we have available to us that are far more democratic than anything we had before. Back in the 70s, using the early broadcaster, it was very powerful, but as we know, it's become fairly corporately owned. And I think the tools we have now to tell the information, tell the stories, and organize around information and leaked information, you know, is through the internet, is through these digital democratic tools that we have available. And this is very much what I feel like my dad was talking about in the early 70s, around mind bombs. And he was creating a mind bomb using powerful media and images to tell these stories that help to shape consciousness. And now we have those even more powerful tools to do just that.
I think I read the description for this movie, said it was a hippie heist movie. And certainly, you know, back then, rightly or wrongly, the environmental movement was closely associated with hippies. But now it seems like a lot of people from a lot of different aspects of life are environmentalists in one way or another. First of all, do you agree with the assessment about a hippie heist movie, hippie heist movement, and how do you think the movement has evolved over the years?
Yeah, well, hippie heist, I mean, it's a nice way, I guess, or not such a nice way, depending on how you look at it, describing the film, but certainly comedic. You know, I would actually say the film is much more than that, much more than a story of a group of hippies in the 1970s. It's actually more getting at the heart of a human story of our capacity to affect change. And that relates and resonates across generations. I've met young people, older people who relate to this film so intimately and personally because it gets more to the human spirit that we have in us or an ability to affect change. That's not just couched in the 70s. That's very much a story for today as well. And then in terms of how it's evolved, I mean, from that story of the 1970s to today, it's gone through many evolutions. The environmental movement has had some heights and some serious lows. You know, that's when the media and the mainstream public is not hearing from us. But, you know, it got very professionalized, I would say, during the 80s and 90s, where it was mainly a lobbying force, mainly getting kind of sound science out there and feeling like the sound science and the right policies would help to change the world. And it may have won us some battles, such as the Montreal Protocol to protect our ozone layer. But in terms of fighting climate change, it just doesn't. It doesn't fight the ideological divide or the corporate opposition. And so today we've had to kind of evolve again with our battle on climate change. And now I think we're seeing much more of a diversity of activism and diversity of environmentalism that it actually can take on many, many shapes, from art to social media to community organizing to co-ops using solar energy power to the sharing economy. You know, you name it, there's many different facets in which it's actually starting to change our way of life in almost all sectors. And that, to me, is a really positive transition when it's not just a movement and not just a small group of hippies or activists. It's becoming a part of all of our everyday lives.
Greenpeace has been criticized in the past for some of their methods or some of their actions. I know the incident in Peru comes to mind, at least for some people. But why initially did Greenpeace feel that sort of the direct action model and putting themselves in harm's way was the right way to go about it?
I think, you know, when you hit certain issues and you've tried everything you can, that are the typical tactics, as I say, of lobbying or protesting, eventually it comes to a point where you've tried everything and nothing's working and you have to try the next step. And that next step is being a disruptor and causing disruptions and trying to actually resist some of the destruction that's going on in the world, whether that's killing whales, whether it's dumping toxic waste into our oceans, you know, you name it. Somebody eventually has to actually just put their bodies in harm's way and say enough is enough and I'm drawing a line in the sand. You can't go here any further. And the planet needs more of those kinds of people. So I think that was part of the original ethos for Greenpeace, is drawing that line in the sand and saying there's people that are willing to do that work. And I still think, again, we need that more than now than ever.
Well, it definitely seems like this generation, you know, the Gen Y, the millennials, and even some of the younger people, the environment is their issue more so than anything else. Why do you think we're seeing sort of this resurgence and this collection of youth that are mobilizing for this cause? Is it because we're starting to see the effects of what is actually happening around us?
Yeah, I think it's a couple of factors. I mean, first, I mean, we grew up with it. We grew up with it more than anybody else. Our parents, you know, were those were the boomers or Gen Xers who were talking about this stuff and talking about, you know, ozone layers and initially some information about climate change and ozone, you know, forestry and various different issues. And we grew up with all that knowledge. And recycling became kind of a norm, and gardening, you know, and riding our bicycle. That now, as we're adults, I think we have a very different value set. We're not so much into individual ownership. We're okay to share things with each other, even share our cars, You know, we want to participate in more community projects that not only bring a social life back to ourselves, but also do what better for the planet, like community gardens, you name it. So I just think that we grew up with this stuff. Our values are very different. And I also think, yeah, we are seeing the effects of climate change right now. We are already living in an era of climate change. And the reality is half the world's population is actually under the age of 30. We have a major force to play in how the future will turn out. And that's a big weight on our shoulders. But with our different value sets and with our different behavior choices, I do think that can be a positive transition rather than kind of a demise one that we've been told for far too long. And I think that partly also it's how we're telling the stories to ourselves. We're so tired of hearing the doom and gloom and the crisis stuff. We want to start talking about the solution and what we're actually doing about it and how we can actually start to achieve change. And that's a real serious conversation I think more and more we're having with ourselves.
How much of that falls on the media in terms of the correct way to frame the issues? You mentioned doom and gloom. Does the media bear a certain obligation when they talk about climate change or other issues affecting the environment?
100%. But the media used to be our force of reasoning and information gathering for us. Now I feel like we have to look outside of the mainstream media to get our information, because quite frankly, there's a real malpractice happening on the issue of climate change. For example, we've been giving a 50-50 debate to climate change for far too long, when the science is out. 97% of all scientific bodies of every government of every country all agree it's real, and we're still acting like this is a debate. That is a malpractice, fundamentally a malpractice, when you give 3% and act like it's a 50-50 debate. So I think that there is a huge weight and responsibility. And I think more and more young people, again, are turning to other alternative media, are looking for more citizen journalism, looking for like live reporting from, Twitter to YouTube to blogs, you name it. We're looking for alternative sources because I don't think we're getting our information anymore in the mainstream. And quite frankly, when the weather reports warn you of storms and weird weather conditions, and they're literally not allowed to say the words climate change, something of a bit of propaganda there as well.
Here in BC, there's sort of two main issues that people are talking about right now. One is, of course, the pipelines that are in various stages of legal wrangling, and also the drought and the lack of water. I'm just wondering if you could comment on those two issues and how we can what you think we need to do to have a dialogue about those.
Yeah, it's a pretty critical time. I mean, we're seeing these fires raging and droughts raging in the West Coast. We're seeing the pipelines, the Energy East, the biggest pipeline that will be ever erected in the world, bigger than Keystone. And it's a really critical time for Canada and where our direction is going. I do feel that this next federal election is as much of a critical one that we've seen potentially in our generation's lifetime. We've seen the wreckage of a Harper administration. We've seen our civil rights go down. We've seen infringement of social justice rights. We've seen more of a heavy-handedness from, police force, you name it. We haven't seen the benefits, also a lot of the economic infrastructure of the tar sands, beyond, yes, some temporary jobs, and frankly, they are temporary. We've seen all this happen, and I frankly think, yeah, if I can be so blunt to say it, I mean, our future in Canada is being sold away for the profiteering of a few small elites in this country that the current administration is handing to. This is not benefiting people. This is not benefiting our democracy, and this is not benefiting the environment of Canada. And so where we go next and is really going to determine things like the pipelines, I think, determine the betterment of our economy and determine whether we're going to have more and more extreme weather because we are continuing on that path or not. And so this federal election, I think we need to get organized. And there's many groups that are doing that, from Greenpeace to Lead Now with VoteTogether.ca and a number of other campaigns that people can get organized around.
Do you think with this, you know, the current status that our economy is in, do we have the budget, do we have the infrastructure to move away from oil and gas and fossil fuels into more alternative energy sources such as, you know, solar or wind power?
I do, and this is part of what I think is missing in the mainstream media around this, is because we are already seeing more investments in the market taking place for renewable energy than for fossil fuels combined. This is not a liberal news source. This is the Bloomberg Business that announced that as of 2013 that was happening. And then by 2030, if we continue down this investment path, it will quadruple the amount that we see in renewable energy infrastructure and investment and jobs, quite frankly. And in fact, things like the tar sands, for example, in terms of direct jobs, there is more jobs in wind than there is actually in direct jobs for the tar sands. So there's a few myths at play around whether we can transition, whether it's going to be good for our economy or not. And actually, we are seeing tremendous strides going towards that renewable energy economy happening already.
Another issue I wanted to touch on that we've seen just a lot of activism around recently, particularly among celebrities, is animal welfare and animal conservation. You mentioned the whales earlier. Of course, there's the dolphin issue in Japan. There was SeaWorld. And lately, there's been the tragic death of Cecil the Lion in Zimbabwe. How does animal conservation tie into the whole environmental movement, would you say?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, these aren't separate issues whatsoever. I mean, I think more and more we need to see how our issues are connected, that it's not just a matter of animal rights, and it's not just a matter of even First Nation rights or, you know, climate change rights or you name it. They're all interconnected. It all comes down, in my opinion, quite frankly, to an economic model that is not in line with social justice or our environmental justice and the environmental sustainability. We're living on a model that wants to have infinite growth on a finite resource world, and is willing to make us all at the expense of that. And again, that's profiting for a few small elite groups of people while the rest of us suffer. And so in a way, I think it's even larger than the environmental movement. I think it's also, to tie into it, an economic issue. And that might seem really large and scary to challenge kind of our economic model, but I think that these questions are coming up more and more and more. You know, whether, you know, you have criticisms about Occupy or not, it gave us a language to speak about the elite system that we're really being run behind, and all of the costs that come with that. And so I think these issues are really all connected. And I think we're seeing movements that are connecting the dots, as I say, with First Nations rights, with environmental groups, with animal rights groups, economic movements. We're seeing more and more of us coming together because we realize it's actually around a systemic change. It's not one issue, one cause at a time. That's kind of old advocacy. Frankly, we need to become interconnected for us to be a movement of movements and really push a systemic transition.
I think I read there was a subtitle on the website for the film that said the revolution will not be organized. And can there sort of be a cord and organization amongst the chaos, kind of like Occupy was?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's where we're going now, because I think, you know, in the beginning, it wasn't organized, and that was kind of the beauty of it. It was organic and spontaneous, and it blossomed. It became something really incredible. But there's a lot of groups that didn't, and you don't even know their name today, you know? Whereas then we kind of saw a surge of really highly central command and control kind of models, a hierarchy of organizations, to remain nameless, but, you know, we all kind of know them. And now I think it's going towards more around kind of what's called distributed organizing, more the model of, say, groups like 350.org, or Greenpeace is also pushing towards this model. A number of groups are pushing towards this model, where we are, there is a centralized hub that can be the help to develop strategies, help to develop connections, resources, give tools and training, but they act as an enabling force for people to champion and become the leaders of their own movements. And in that way, we have a more leaderful movement, and we're also growing and expanding with more and more people involved in it than just a small group that are staffed at an organization. So I think that it is that mix. You still need a kind of a central hub to help provide some of those tools and resources and strategy, but we need to enable people and enable this movement to grow than try to control it any longer.
Well, the film is How to Change the World, directed by Jerry Rothwell, and it opens August 7th in Toronto, Montreal, in Vancouver, and then a smattering of other cities throughout Canada over the coming weeks and months. Emily Hunter, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
All right, have a good one. Cheers.
Thanks so much.
That was Emily Hunter, and the new film is How to Change the World. Up next, you'll hear from two queer youth, Storm and Z, about what it means to be a gender.
So I've got Storm, and I've got Z as part of our Pride documentary on the Plus community. And you two both describe yourselves as agender. How would you describe what agender is?
Ooh, I got this in the bag. Are you a boy or a girl? No.
That's basically it. It's like, agender, to me is, I describe it as, I don't identify or feel comfortable being identified as a male or a female, or any binary gender.
Okay.
I'm just kind of feel like a person that, you know, just I'm here, but like, as Z said, are you a boy or a girl?
No.
I'm a being of pure energy with no weaknesses.
So you would describe that then differently than a transgendered person, for example, who is,
yes,
who is the opposite gender of what they were born in.
Yeah,
it's not the opposite. It's transitioning to a different gender,
right,
because there's,
yeah,
more than boys and girls and boys.
Yes.
Hence why we exist.
But yeah, transgender or transsexuals are people that are born as one gender and decide to sex.
It's a common misconception.
Yeah. That are born as one sex and wish to full-on transition to either the opposite or another sex, altogether, all together.
Sorry, I screwed them up.
But agenders, it is not transgendering because we don't have a gender. We don't identify.
We're also not transitioning from one thing to the other. We are just existing in one, any stereotypical or societal obligations of a gender put on us.
So would you sort of say it's more along the lines of gender queer, or do you identify that as a different sort of identity as well?
Gender queer, to my knowledge, is short for questioning gender. So I apply the gender queer thing, well, like, you know, this is me, it can mean different things to other people, but with me, I put it as people that are not yet sure, like they're questioning.
There's a lot of people who don't know if they're agender or gender fluid, which is a very fine line. It's like, are you a boy or a girl? No. Are you a boy or a girl? Yes.
Are you a boy or a girl? I don't know.
Right, like Ruby Rose would be gender fluid.
Yeah.
So she describes herself.
Yeah.
But she, you know, but she also talks about why she's not in the transition. And now I know
she also happens to use she, her, and hers.
Right.
There's a lot of agenders who present as masculine or feminine to fit into the gender binary to go make their lives easier, because a lot of people who are outside of the binary get bullied to get put back into the binary. Mm-hmm. So a lot of us have like a,
that our pronouns are not
grammatically
correct.
Oh my god, I want to.
Which it's
explicitives.
Explicitives. It's in the dictionary. It's been a recognized pronoun for like,
since the 17th century.
They?
Yeah.
They,
yeah,
has,
as
been
a
recognized
pronoun.
Yeah.
And there's another one going around in the States. This performer Justin Bond uses the pronoun MX rather than Mr. or Mrs. It's just mix.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they legalized that in England a few months ago.
Yes.
I'm happy that there is a legally recognized third gender finally appearing. I might have gone with an easier-to-pronounce thing than a mix.
You know, I mean, Storm, you're still 16, and I know you're 20, but I'm curious, like, how did this identity affect you during the school, because you often talked about, you know, you were told that your pronoun is wrong, so,
yeah,
You know, I still get told my pronoun is wrong at 20
so
in outside
I.
communities.
Even in
LGBTQ communities, I get told my pronoun's wrong.
Well, when I was in school, it was 100% impossible to have my pronouns, which I just went with they, them, and their, to be used, and therefore to avoid being identified as just a female, which is something I am against with myself. I had to allow people to refer to me as he, him, and I still have to let people refer to me as he, him at home and in public because of the fact that they won't use they, them. But that presented its own issues as that caught the attention of the transphobics and the bullying started, and needless to say, I'm no longer in school.
Now, I know, in addition to this, so we've talked about the gender aspect, and I know, Storm, you also say you're demisexual.
Yeah.
Which is not a term, which is a term probably that a lot of people aren't familiar with. We're just hearing now about asexual. My understanding is that demisexual is sort of somewhere between the two, between asexual.
Yeah. That is incorrect.
And having sexual attraction. How would you describe it?
Can I handle this one, actually?
Well,
I only found out about demisexual yesterday from me.
Okay. Well, I'd heard about it. I just didn't know the exact description.
Okay. Demisexual is not the halfway point. Demisexual refers to people who only experience sexual attraction to somebody if they have a very strong emotional connection to them. And even then, it can take years to develop an actual want to do anything
sexual.
Well,
I could have explained that, Z. I know that.
I'm continuing on and explaining other things, too. I'm just getting a whole broad horizon.
Okay.
Well, maybe
plus
I should
I
explain
to
gray sexual. Basically, how I describe it is, as Z said, it's like, I don't feel sexual. Will you stop?
I'm sorry, I'm high on sugar and very distracting right now.
Yeah.
Sleep.
I don't experience strong or at all any sexual attraction towards, any kind of gender or any of that. You've messed me up now.
Whereas asexuals just feel no attraction.
They feel no attraction at all. I'm talking.
But I feel like, now, correct me if I'm wrong, but demisexuals, they can
have
the attraction and the pleasure, but only after a sustained period of time.
Well, it depends on the person, really. Like, with me, even in, like, the once or twice I've ever actually have felt any kind of sexual attraction, like, I wasn't sure if it was because I'm not used to it, but it took me, like, a really long time to feel anything like that. And it's like, so we're capable of feeling the attraction.
And the pleasure.
And the pleasure.
It's a physical reaction.
Yes.
We just don't get the psychological pleasure from it as well, like
yeah.
most monosexuals do, which is the term for people who aren't asexuals or graces or demis.
Right.
Yeah. So, what was I saying?
You were talking about...
I have the ability to feel it. It's just 99.99999999999999 percent of the time, I won't.
And Z, I've heard you just been described as a gray sexual or ace gray, asexual towards the gray. So what exactly does that mean?
Gray sexual is its own little, like, umbrella, because it refers to a lot of different things. Mainly it's referred to people who aren't sure if they're fully demi or asexual, usually, or if they just go long periods of time without wanting sex. or having any need for it. And it's a common, it's a really big misconception that asexuals don't want anything to do with sex. There are some asexuals that will have sex with their partner because they know their partner wants that and they want to please their partner. There's some asexuals who are like, ew, sex, no, get it away from me. And that's okay too. That doesn't make them naive or childish. They just don't like sex. It can be very gross. There's also, asexuals can get aroused. They just don't feel the need to do anything about it. They don't need to go after somebody because they feel aroused because of the person. And there's asexuals who masturbate. It happens.
Right.
It's a very big misconception that I want to debunk right there.
And you told me before we started that you identify as panromantic. Now, people, I'm sure, have by now heard the term pansexual. But how would you say panromantic is different than pansexual, if at all?
Well, I'm demi-panromantic, which means I'm demisexual, but it's like being pansexual, but there's just no sex. It's just panromantic. I want to hold hands, I want to kiss, I want to cuddle, I want to watch movies, I want the long walks on the beach and the sunset.
Really?
Well, actually, under the stars.
Really?
Yes, yes. I want all of the
romantic... You want the love, you want the Shakespearean thing.
So,
yes.
So you're more into the romance and the emotional connection rather than any actual like physical intimacy.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
And because I'm demi, every once in a while, I'll feel the need for a snog, but that's as far as it goes. Just kissing, and then back to cuddling and watching movies.
And is it sort of that the same as you being demi, or is it a little more extreme than that?
Well, let me just leave them right there. Demisexual is a sexuality, but you can be a demisexual and then some other kind of romantic. Like right now I kind of switch between aromantic and something that it, I don't even know if it has a name, so I'm just gonna go, yeah, same. It usually ends up as panromantic. I just I should have asked you this before. Like, I've noticed that no matter what, I have a tendency to never feel or want to be in relationships with, and this might sound a little harsh, but...
Owners of dicks.
Yeah.
There you go.
The That's owners it. Of dicks. Actual dicks.
You kind of alluded to this earlier, but... The LGBTQ community has, at least the acronym has expanded a lot in recent years, but do you guys find that even within that community there's a lot of either specific phobias that certain members have, or there's just a way of treating people that maybe isn't what you would expect from within that community?
Definitely.
Yeah.
But it's almost always from people who live through the HIV epidemic. It's always the senior LGBTQ people who are like, no, you have to be either gay or lesbian or straight. There's no in between. There's even biphobia still, which is bleep 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 bleep,
so,
ridiculous.
So, well, that brings up an interesting point about whether these phobias is less to do with gender and sexuality and more to do with just the generations and how the older generation thinks as compared to the younger generation.
Well, that's always going to be a factor in any kind of phobia, in my opinion. Like,
yeah.
With the difference in generations and how people were raised.
Like, take for instance, the word queer. Nowadays, LGBTQ people want to refer to the LGBTQTA+ community as queer because it's shorter and less of a mouthful, because let's face it, that acronym is ridiculous nowadays.
But queer used to mean
a
odd,
horrible, horrible slur that would get you beaten up and possibly killed, if not worse things.
Well, but,
yeah.
I mean, same with gay too. I mean, the community kind of brought that back in a way too, right?
We have a name for those kind of things. They're reclaimed terms.
Yes.
So we took these things and we reclaimed them as positive things for ourselves.
Yeah, there's still a lot of people though who aren't okay with that.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's going to be people who aren't okay with it for pretty much ever until we actually fully reclaim the word. Which I think we're getting close to.
We're getting there.
Yeah.
In terms of just the dialogue about it, especially with the older generations, how do you communicate? Or do you try to?
There's some sort of internal radar on most genderqueer individuals and agenders and gender fluids and bigenders and all the non-binaries, where we have this, like, you're going to be an asshole about this, I can tell.
Yeah, so basically, usually if we feel like somebody is not going to, like, you know, if that radar tells us that this person's going to be an asshole, we don't do it.
We sort of just go by what people would assume of us, or what we're like trans-passing almost, and we're not trying to, it's just what we have to do to fit into society nowadays.
Wait, it seems kind of odd now that, you know, sort of trans people is now like the, you know, we had the huge transphobia a couple years ago, and now trans is like the passable sexuality or passable gender in a lot of ways.
Well, yeah. Here's a thing I want to just say about trans being acceptable, though. Male or female to male, that's generally pretty well accepted these days. However, male to female, generally, especially by, like, public, they have, I mean, I'm not saying that not, that all trans people don't have hardships. It's hard for everybody, but I actually believe
the women are still on the bottom, whether they have a dick or not.
Yeah. But I mean, I think we're seeing a shift in that with both, like, people like Laverne Cox, Caitlyn Jenner, Janet Locke.
Yeah, it's getting...
Ruby Rose.
It's getting places. I'm not saying that it's not, but I do want to say that from what I can see...
We still have a long way to go.
Yeah, but I still think that trans women still have a little bit of a more difficult time.
I think it's different difficulties.
It's different difficulties for sure.
Because you'll find that...
Each thing has its own things that...
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, how would you compare those difficulties that you just addressed to sort of the difficulties that you would face being, you know, demisexuals, agender people?
Well, as a demisexual, you don't really get a lot of attention, and in a way, that is itself in its own violence, but most of the time, people don't even know, because they don't even think to ask. I know for...
a lot of people... or even if you just say that you're asexual or let alone demisexual stuff, if you say, you know, I don't feel sexual attraction or something, the other person is usually just going to be like, you're not in the mood for it right now or something.
You haven't found the right person.
Yeah, you haven't found the right girl, you haven't found the right guy.
Or worse, you get, something like rape correction.
Yeah, that's the thing. They think you just haven't tried it yet. You don't know how good it actually is.
Which usually traumatizes them way more and makes them even more sure that they are not going to ever have sex again. Very much sure. And plus, representation in movies and in shows and books and stuff, asexuals are always treated like they're goddamn robots. We have personalities. We have wants and desires. We are not just some cold... hearted asshole who likes math.
I wanted to address that because we're seeing a lot more trans visibility now in the media. The people that we just talked about, Orange Is the New Black, is doing a great job of that. But sort of once you get past the T/Q area of the acronym, you don't see a lot of visibility. And you know, does the media and do entertainment shows, do they have an obligation to portray these people, or is it up to the members of that community?
I think it's an obligation of the media because, for one, the world's not all white. For two, the world is all not white men. Three, not all white cis men. Not all white cis straight men. There is more to the goddamn world than that.
Right.
And if you take a look at pretty much any blockbuster hit right now, count the ratio of men to women. Count how much screen time the men have to the women. Like,
count.
Well, sexism has been
look
and
at
count the ethnicity.
Look at the difference between the men and women's personalities.
Yep.
Like, look at how they portray the women and the men.
Also, you can't represent an entire gender in one person.
That, no.
Yeah, it just doesn't. Like, we have the token woman, the token ethnicity character, and the token queer character that gets thrown into it to make sure that PR can say, oh, but we have a queer person. Oh, but we have an ethnic person.
But here's another thing I'd like to just point out about agenders and stuff in media. I'm just going to throw in a quick reference here. Steven Universe. Steven Universe.
Goddamn, that
crystal
show is amazing.
Gems. Yes.
I don't even like the show, and I appreciate the show so much.
However, look at this. There are the crystal gems. None of them are... they are technically a gender. They don't have a gender, but yet people in the show decide to refer to them as female.
Because they're female presenting. Like, I am an agender
male
presenting.
However, just want to say, let me finish.
Sorry.
This happens in a lot of shows, even where characters don't particularly present as any character, people will give them a binary gender just to make it easier for themselves,
or so that they don't have to explain to their child what an agender is.
Yeah. Like the
of course, if they're watching Steven Universe, it's already too late. Dem space rocks.
Ruby and Sapphire.
Dem space rocks. And goddamn Pearl and Rose.
You know, because they were talking about, like, shows like Glee specifically, and even other stuff like Will and Grace.
I have not seen Glee, and I have no wish to.
I think what they were talking was, like, what, you know, when Glee came out, then suddenly every TV show either had a gay character or a lesbian character. Or a bi character.
No, just...
Oh,
what
please, I would
said.
Love a goddamn bi
gay
character. No one who says
or
the B word.
Lesbians.
Well, Glee had both, but...
And Glee sucked at its representation.
Well, that's my next point, is that the media has sort of conquered those two specific sexualities. And we're starting to see trans now. But beyond that...
They skipped fucking bi.
Actually, there's a show out right now.
That has one bi character.
I forget the name of it, but she identifies as bisexual. And actually, Doctor Who.
Oh, thank God. There's
Doctor Who.
No, Captain Jack would be pansexual or bisexual, depending on...
He is omnisexual. He will fuck anything that is over the age of consent and has a heartbeat.
I'm sorry, if...
Actually,
what?
Actually, no. He would be omnispecies, wouldn't he?
Yes. Jack,
sexual.
If you can say yes and you are above the age of consent and you have a heartbeat... That's literally Jack's only two stigmas about sex. He is fantastic.
Yes. So there's that.
Yes. But it's never...
Storm? Yeah.
Can I just bring something back to you saying that they've conquered the idea of lesbians and gay people in media?
No.
Because have you ever looked at how they portray the gay and the lesbians?
It is.
Have you noticed how
always
stereotypical it is? Like, girl, or where, like...
The gays are always extremely flamboyant, and the girls are
mean
either...
girls. Mean girls.
I mean,
the gay boy, Damien.
I suppose.
I don't think I've watched that.
I suppose, like Will and Grace, for example. They had one very flamboyant gay character, but the other gay male was a little more straight laced.
Honestly.
But then again, it was two white gay males.
Two white cis gay males.
Yes.
A, we need way more minorities in our shows, and B, we need way more queer characters. Like, there should be, like, a token white straight person.
Well, how are you defining queer in that context?
Anything that is from the acronym, and anything that isn't white. Meaning North American, good English speaking, pale skinned.
Sound like just, yeah, so Caucasian.
Oh, and not British.
No.
No offense against the British. I love their accent. It's gorgeous. And most of them are really nice, like the ones that I've met are really nice.
That's just British.
What?
I love the British people.
But so do I.
The Greeks, the Germans, the Italians, they all don't count as white. They are their own culture. And if they're allowed to show that on the show, then they can be in there. If they have to act white to be in the show, no. Don't do it. That's mean. That's cruel. Russian people.
Why do you think... Well, two questions. Why do you think it's taking so long to talk about some of these, you know...
The enforced gender binary from birth. Go into a baby shop and look at the baby jumpers. The boys will have superheroes on them. Girls' baby jumper, or girl-designated baby jumpers, will say, I hate my thighs on them. We are literally taught from the moment we come out of the... Even before we come out of the womb, we're having gender reveal parties for the babies. The baby is a goddamn potato. It doesn't know anything about genders.
Well, there was a...
Through it.
You brought up an interesting point that you said that your mom is a queer person. And, you know, I don't know if you guys have thought about the future at all, but, like, if you end up ever do having children or offspring, how would you want your children to identify you as?
All right, well, let me just say one thing right there. I don't have...
Fingers are up and crossed, like, you know,
yeah, just let me just...
both storming zero, putting the ixnay on having kids.
Biological children on my front. If my partner does really want to have kids and we sit down and talk about it, then I will adopt. Because there are enough children who need good homes. We do not need to bring in any more children who will just get beat up.
As somebody who lives in the ministry, under the care of the ministry, and I know how many kids there actually are out there, that they have trouble even finding room for them in the ministry. There are kids staying in hotels because they don't have houses. So why would I want to bring another child into the world? Partly because that would involve doing the D.
Oh my god, that's adorable.
And two. What? Okay, yeah, so one, that would involve that, which, as I mentioned earlier, the D's not for me. It's not going to happen. That will never come anywhere near me. And two, why would I bring another child in the world and run the risk of having him have, or her, or them, having it run the risk of having to deal with all this kind of stuff when there's a lot of children out there without good homes, in the ministry care with foster parents or group home workers that don't understand...
Or
how they're going
don't
through.
Care.
Don't care. They understand and they don't care. So why would I just bring a new child into the world when I could just take one of those and give it, you know,
a healthy, loving family?
Yeah.
So basically what Storm is saying is that apathy is dead.
It is. it doesn't exist.
Now, when Storm told me about you, the way they described you was, oh, there's a half-blonde vampire walking around.
Yeah.
And I'm curious as to whether your vampirism, if I can call it that, is a part of any, like, part of your gender identity or part of your sexuality, or if it's just a personality trait.
It is just a personality trait. And for me, actually, I am now wearing the fangs, even... You might be able to tell because of the very slight lisp that I worked very hard to get rid of.
Oh, you put your
you can describe,
fangs
like,
in.
These are pretty big, yeah?
Yeah.
Giant fangs in. I started doing cosplay a number of years ago when I was 14, so that's 6 years now, and one of the characters required fangs. And the first time I wore fangs, it was like immediate safety blanket, and it was amazing. They're like a fidget toy that no one can tell you're fidgeting with, and it's amazing.
I just wanted to touch on one thing briefly about cosplay, which has exploded now. But it sort of seems like within that community, within the nerd community in general, that's been another community that has both been very supportive of LGBTQ people, but we've also seen some phobias towards them as well, particularly from sort of the cis white male aspect of that community. How would you describe, as a queer person, your experience within the nerd community?
Overall, extremely healthy and extremely good for my mental health. And, like, I found so many friends through them, through the community. I found so many outlets for stress in my personal life. It's a little expensive going to conventions, but honestly, if you haven't been to a convention, you just can't understand the feeling of going to one.
Did I miss a question? I'm sorry. What was the question?
Stop reading your books, damn it. The feeling of going to a con, the best I can describe, is like going on a really long road trip and finally coming back home to that pet or family member that loves you and has, like, fresh-baked cookies for you right out of the oven. And you just feel like you can finally come home and you go to your own bed for the first time in years. And you just are surrounded by people who finally understand you. Even if they're not a fan of the same show or book as you, they get it. They get the ostracization of wanting to dress up in costumes and be somebody else for a day.
Well, I'm curious, like, do you see the parallel at all between sort of the loneliness and sort of ostracization one might see as a member of the queer community versus one might see as a member of the nerd community?
Yes, completely. Actually, through conventions, the first character I dressed up as, I had to do transition work to look like them. And I realized when I got called by the different pronoun than I was used to, I realized, oh, that felt really good. And I started doing my own work on that, because I got called that pronoun throughout the day because people thought I was that. I was the gender that I was trying to pass as. And I went home and I realized, once I was getting back to my other pronoun, that I didn't like that pronoun so much. It didn't feel good to me anymore. And that's what started my whole exploration of gender pronouns. And, and being both a queer person and a cosplayer, if you try to be anything other than what media represents as normal, ... you're going to get bullied, beat up, ostracized, and isolated from anything comforting. And having all those people who have felt the very same thing as you for being who they are come together in the same place, you can just feel everybody relax. There's no more guards up. There's no more fear of getting hurt or getting rejected because, like, unless you're, like, except for, like, hey, do you know this fandom? No, sorry. It looks really cool, though. Like, that is as much rejection as you're going to find at a con, and it's fantastic.
I'm stretching, sorry.
Well, this has been great.
Sorry, I talk a lot.
No, it's great.
It's
documentary style, so this is going to be good. Yeah, it's going to be part of our plus, that's what I'm calling it. Plus. Yeah, it's our...
I'm sorry I disappeared for a while. This is a
storm,
really...
Storm tends to disappear. It's all good. But thanks. Thanks.
Any follow-up questions or wrap-up questions?
I guess just with Pride coming up this weekend, there's been a bit of a controversy, this year, specifically around the trans pledge that people have to sign if they want to take part. But
what's this about?
So, like, the Liberal government, for example, can't march because they refuse to sign the trans pledge, that the pride, like the people who organize the pride, like the parade, says if you want to, if you not only want to be a sponsor, but if you want to march and have a float, you have to sign this trans pledge agreement as as part of the, and a lot of them say, and a lot of them say, well, you can't force people to do that.
Well, we can force you not to go in our parade.
That's true.
I'm assuming the trans pledge is a pledge to protect trans individuals?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Well, yeah, I mean, we can't force them to sign it, but you know what? If, well, you know, like Z said, you know, we have the choice that if you don't want to help protect trans
a valid
people,
human
why,
being.
Yeah, why are you... Why should you have the right to march in our parade?
Our pride parade is literally pride for people who are ostracized and bullied and left out of things like you're trying to do.
It's not a freaking publicity campaign for the government.
It's not a free publicity stunt. You either are fully accepting of every human and their individual right to express themselves outside or inside the gender binary the way that they want to, regardless of their born or assigned sex at birth, then you don't deserve to be in the goddamn pride parade.
No, but on that note, we talked about earlier about, you know, a lot of phobias being present within the queer community itself. So how do you sort of reconcile that with...
There is more than one person in the pride community, so there can be more than one attitude towards the trans community and the agender community. There are people in the queer community who are transphobic, and there are people who are not. I am very, very thankful that there are not transphobic people high up in the authority of the Vancouver Pride Parade and are enforcing a trans pledge to anybody who is participating. That makes me really happy, actually.
On the subject of that... Otherkin pronouns.
That is a long and lengthy topic that I don't think has time.
Otherkin, that's for our next documentary.
Yes. LGB is, like, finally crawling out of the hole of ostracization and bullying and just like, yay, we're free! And T is, like, on the rope going, guys, I need a little help! And Q and Plus are down at the very bottom of the hole, like, we can't reach the rope! Could you throw it down a little more?
But then, you know, A and I's are some sort of, you know, 1,000 miles away.
A and I's. I, is that... Was that intersex?
Yes.
Okay, actually,
that's my understanding.
I just have a quick thing to say about that, because actually the LGBTQ group I was in just the other day, we were decorating our banner and stuff for Pride, and one of the people that were painting it, they had a talk with us because they were like, we weren't sure if we should put an intersex flag on this, because some intersex people might not want to be grouped with the rest of the LGBTQ community, like the transsexuals and stuff, because...
That's the first time I've heard of it, but, I mean, I can sort of understand it. They just want to be viewed as part of the binary, because they've been put out of it from the moment they were born.
Yeah.
Yeah. So... Well, that,
I don't know, that's a tricky topic.
So basically how I just, I brought that up because I just want to say that everyone has a different way of identifying their gender or their sexuality or how they do it. Like, some people might not want to be grouped with others because of how they identify, because they could have a different definition for themselves than what is...
generally considered the social acceptableness.
Basically the same way with anything, because while there could be really similar things, and yeah, there's probably going to be some people that do identify more or less the same, but there could, like, people could have different things in their identity that you might not know or that people don't fully understand.
Well, that's the show for this week. Be sure to tune next week when my guest will be legendary punk drummer Marky Ramone. My thanks to Storm, Z, and Emily Hunter. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next week. Bye, everybody. Bye.